I want you to imagine that you are dead. You're not going to imagine very much if you're dead, is it? No, okay, you have been dead. Let's put it that way. You've been dead. You've been asleep in the sleep of death. And you have been baptized. You have gone ahead and kept the faith. You've been repenting regularly and, you know, changing and adapting your life to in line with what Christ and God the Father demand of us. And you are resurrected. And the resurrection that you're in, you wake up and you look around and it's dark. It's dark because, you know, the moon is turned to blood and the sun is turned to darkness. And an angelic being is beside you. And you then start to rise. And you're in the first resurrection. I mean, that's the goal that we all have. And as you rise and you go up through the clouds, you know, the darkness fades away as you really zoom up through the clouds. And as you get above the clouds and you actually get out into the away beyond the atmosphere, you look back and you can see the circle of the earth. And along the side of the circle of the earth, you also see space itself. You can see the sun in the distance and the moon further over. And in the actual space itself, there's a tear. And the entire space and the stars that you would be looking at the other side have been rolled back. And this tear comes actually in the fabric of reality itself, and you can look right into another reality, and you're heading towards this tear. And as you get closer to this tear, you can see things within this tear within space, and you start going into that particular area, and there are, let's call them, you know, Ezekiel called them creatures, let's call them vehicles for want of a better word today, but huge vehicles of some description folding in on itself with a, you know, you read the account in Ezekiel about this kind of fire that is folding in on itself, and they have various faces as it was being described. I was talking in the car actually going along, and we were talking about how if you were looking at a vehicle, well, how would you describe a vehicle? You know, you're driving along the motorway and you see, well, there's all these beetles on four legs. And they're zooming along this flat paved area, and they've got two eyes coming out of the side, the wing mirrors, okay? And there's the face of a man in the two eyes, because you look in the wing mirrors and you see the face of the driver as he's driving along. You know, all these kind of descriptions that you'd have, and you would see then, you'd see what it was that Ezekiel was actually seeing. This creature, this vehicle, whatever it was. And you actually led into one of these vehicles, and you're then in a room, and you're being briefed about what in fact has gone on since your death. You see an awful lot of other people that have been resurrected from that time as well. And you attend this particular briefing, and as after the briefing, then others join. You know, I say after the briefing, I mean after some period of time, others join that you recognize that have been alive, and they've lived right the way through, and they then join you. And you're all together then, and you're your old friends that you'll be able to meet again. And they will then be debriefed and briefed. And then the whole armada starts to move out. And it moves out towards the earth, and it starts to go east to west around the earth, and moves its entire way, right the way around the earth. And as you came down, presumably missiles had been fired and they disintegrated. Aircraft have been attacking you. They were disintegrated. There were some kind of rays that were coming out of the side of some of these vehicles, according to Habakkuk. And then it stops. And perhaps there are even angelic horses of some description. You know, what we would term a horse that Christ is riding, because it talks about him riding on a horse. So, you know, are there angelic kind of horses that are ridden? I'm not sure, but you've seen all this kind of thing going on, these things that you've read about. And then the whole thing stops, and you get out. You can get out, and you get out above the clouds, and the whole group starts to descend through the clouds as a one mass to a particular spot on this earth. And there's lightning, and there's a huge noise that, you know, would break any natural human's eardrums if they were right beside you. As you're actually descending through the clouds there, and the lightnings and the the power that is available, and you come down to this particular spot, and the actual ground itself splits, and the entire, all the people that were with you, all the individuals, the angelic beings that are with you, you land on this particular spot, the two sides of this hill that you just landed on split in two, and you're looking across at a piece of real estate. You're looking across at a piece of real estate. Now, if we turn over to Zechariah 14, where are you? And let's face it, whether you live or whether you die, this is the kind of thing that you'll be looking forward to. If you die, it's something along those lines that will happen. If you live, you will rise after the ones that have been resurrected, and then you'll return, again you'll come down in the same way as you saw Christ go, as they saw Christ go, he'll return in the same way. That's why I say you get out, and then you descend, and that splits this mountain in two halves. And here in Zechariah 14, and in verse 2, it says, "For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem." This is the bit of real estate, Jerusalem. "To battle, and the city will be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished, and half the city will go forth to captivity. The residue of the city shall not be cut off from the city. And then shall the Eternal go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle." So after this event, you then have the Eternal returning and fighting against these nations that have done this to Jerusalem. "And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall split in the midst thereof, for, towards the east and towards the west. And there will be a very great valley, and half the mountain shall remove down towards the north, and half of it down towards the south." So it will split east to west as his feet touch, and it will go north and south. The half of it will go down south, half of it will move north when that will actually take place. And if we just turn over to Joel, or turn back a little bit to Joel, in Joel, we find a little bit more as to what is about to happen when we find the resurrected saints with Christ at the very beginning of the kingdom of God at this particular time. Here in Joel chapter 3, we find in verse 2, it says, "And I will also gather all nations, and I will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat. And I will plead with them there for my people and my heritage Israel, that they scattered among the nations and parted my land." Now, put a marker in there, if you've got a marker somewhere, in Joel 3. And let's turn to a place where I don't know whether in a sermon, whether you've ever actually turned there before. And that is the map in the back of your Bible. Most of you have got maps in the back of your Bible. I want you to find a map. Now, in my Oxford Wide Margin Bible, it's the last one. It's map number 9. The one on Jerusalem, if you've got one on Jerusalem. If not, then you'll have to look over somebody's shoulder. But the one on Jerusalem, here in map number 9, if not, then I'll try and describe it to you. But looking down on the map of Jerusalem, you've got the temple area on the right-hand side, on the east side. On the east of the temple area, there is a valley. That's the Kidron Valley today. That's called the Kidron Valley today. And that valley runs north-south along the side, along the east side of Jerusalem. The Mount of Olives is the other side of that valley. So you're looking, that's where the feet will touch, and that's where the split will occur. And it will go north-south. It will split to the north, it will split to the south, and the valley will then run east-west. And this valley, this Kidron Valley, between the temple area and the Mount of Olives, that's also known as the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, if we go back, therefore, and just out of interest, while we're here and looking at the map, I want you to notice the south side of the actual Jerusalem, you find the Valley of Hinnom. That's also known as Gehenna. That's the Valley of Hinnom, which is Gehenna. It's where the refuse was burnt, and the dung gate was at the south side of Jerusalem, which allowed the refuse to come out of the dung gate and be dumped in the Valley of Hinnom. Let's come back to that a little bit later on, but if we go back to Joel again, and read a little bit more. Let's pick it up in verse 9. It says, proclaim you this among the Gentiles. Joel 3, verse 9. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares to swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say that I am strong. Assemble yourselves. Come up, all you heathen, and gather yourself together around about. There cause the mighty ones to come down, O Eternal. So the mighty ones are actually coming down. And they're coming, the ones are coming up to Jerusalem, and the mighty ones are coming down. Let the nations be awake and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, why is it up? Because Jerusalem, this area, this piece of real estate, is about 3,500 feet above the Dead Sea. It's 2,500 feet above sea level. It's on the top. It's on the top of the hills. And this is why it says, let them come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. You know, up to the valley, it seems rather strange, but no, that's what you'd do. You'd actually come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, which is at the side. Remember, you're looking at the valley of Jehoshaphat, which is running between the Mount of Olives, which is just split, and also the temple area, which is on the other side. For there I will sit to judge all the nations around about. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, get you down, for the press is full, the vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. The day of the Eternal is near in the valley of decision. And this valley of decision is the valley of Jehoshaphat, right on the side of Jerusalem. The sun and moon will be darkened. The stars will withdraw their shining. As I said, when you're resurrected, you'll find that it's dark, because the moon will be turned, it says here in verse 31 of the preceding chapter, the sun will be turned to darkness, the moon to blood, before the great and terrible day of the Eternal comes. And in verse 16, the Eternal also shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. Remember, he'll return with a shout, the voice of the archangel, with the trump of God. And it's the shofar that's blown, this blast that will occur as he descends. The heavens and the earth will shake, but the Eternal will be the hope of his people and the strength of the people of Israel. So shall you know that I am the Eternal, your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. And then shall Jerusalem be holy, and there shall be no strangers pass there through her any more. So here we see this particular event taking place. And if we go back to the maps again and just start understanding a little bit more. So here we see the Kidron Valley, this valley of Jehoshaphat. We see the actual temple area, or the Jerusalem proper, on the other side. We've got the Mount of Olives on that side. Now, if you find another map, go and find another map, just turn back a few pages, and look at the entirety of the Holy Land, you know, where you've got Galilee at the north, and you've got the Dead Sea at the south. And to find Jerusalem, you come to the top of the Dead Sea, and you go due west about 20 miles, and there's Jerusalem, where the Jordan River runs into the Dead Sea. You go due west, and there's Jerusalem, almost due west from the place where the Jordan reaches the Dead Sea. If you go to the Sea of Galilee, which is in the north, and you go due west from the Sea of Galilee, about in the middle, you come to Mount Carmel on the coast. You find Mount Carmel like a projection on the coast. Now, Carmel, actually, as I understand it, would even have snow on it. It was quite a high mountain. And if you notice, from Mount Carmel, or just north of Mount Carmel, going in a southeasterly direction, in other words, going down at a 45-degree angle, that is Megiddo, the Vale of Megiddo, the Valley of Megiddo, otherwise known as Armageddon. That's the gathering place. So when it says, now come up to the Valley of Decision, they're coming from this area, this Armageddon, this Valley of Megiddo, and they're coming then up, because remember, you're looking at a mountain range, or a range of hills, at about 2,500 feet where Jerusalem is, and they're coming up to that area, and that's where, when you read over in Revelation 14:20, you can put it in your notes, you don't have to turn there, but in Revelation 14:20, where the blood will come up to the horses' bridles. It will be in that area, right beside Jerusalem, that this battle will take place, and the entire kingdoms of this world will become the kingdoms, the Lord and his Christ. And this is the defining moment at that particular time. Now what I want to do today, what I want to talk about today, is I want to talk about probably the most important piece of real estate, not just in this world, but the most important piece of real estate probably in the universe. When you really think about it and what its future is going to be, you're looking at the most important piece of real estate probably in the universe today. Because this is going to form the point where the New Jerusalem is going to actually come down to. It'll be the geographic center of the kingdom of God for eternity. It's a focal point of prophecy. Is it any wonder that Satan wants to trash this area? If there's any area that he is riled about, it will be this area of the world. And so when we see certain of the prophecies regarding Jerusalem, then you can see a certain mind at work in this world. And the irony of it, because Satan is wanting this entire area destroyed, is when you look at the name Jerusalem. Do you know what Jerusalem means? It means city of peace, doesn't it? Yeah, city of peace. It is a city of peace. But it's a bit more than that. Because Yaru does not mean city. It's Yaru Shalom. That's the basic breakdown of the word, Yaru Shalom. And Yara means to throw, to shoot, to pour. It's the pouring of peace. It's the pointing of peace. Do you know where we, another word that's linked to Yaru? It's Torah. It's the law. Torah comes from the base root of Yaru. It's the pointing. It's the way. It's going to point the way to peace. That's what Jerusalem, the very name of Jerusalem means. It's the pointing of the way to peace. It's interesting also, Zion. Do you know what Zion? Do you know what a Zion was? A Zion was known as a waymark, as a signpost. It points the way. That's what Zion means. So here you have Jerusalem, Yaru Shalom, the pouring or the pouring of peace, and Zion being there, the waymark that will point the way. And even within those names, if you turn over to Revelation 3, turn with me just back to Revelation 3 and have a look and see what the prophecy regarding Philadelphia is specifically, where it says in verse 11, it says, "Behold, I'll come quickly, hold that fast which you have, that no man takes your crown." And that's that first resurrection is what we're looking at as regarding the crown. "Him that overcomes will I make a pillar in the temple of my God," and what you see assembled in there, and if you read in Revelation where it says it looks into, you see Christ coming, and it also talks about looking into, and there within that tear, within that that tear in the clouds where the sky rolls back, is the temple of God. And it's the Ark of the Covenant within there. Because the Ark of the Covenant is central. It is the law, the Torah, which will be there. "Him that overcomes will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will go no more out. And I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I'll write upon him my new name." So one of the names being written on the people of God, specifically linked to the time that we're in, well, not necessarily we're in now, but we have in fact lived through regarding Philadelphia, is this name, Yaru Shalom. This pointing, this pouring of peace. And that is what we are going to have to actually bring to this world in large degree. So it's very interesting that we can go back and we can see a little bit of the history of this place, of Jerusalem. And I want to go and have a look at the early history, first of all. I then want to go into the time of David and Solomon and show you, in fact, what happened in around Jerusalem around the time of David and Solomon, because it became prominent at that particular time. The early history, it wasn't as prominent, except going back to Melchizedek's time. I then want to go into after Babylon to the time of Christ and talk about that particular period of time. Then fourthly, I want to talk about Christ to the present day, which is a fair swathe of history as we go into this particular area. And finally, I want to look into the future and as we've been doing, and as we've been kind of looking into the future a little bit and imagining what it's going to be like, certainly we'll be looking at the future at the end of the sermon. So going into the earlier history, as I say, you're looking at the position of Jerusalem. It was about 2,500 feet elevated above sea level. And if you notice over in Genesis 14, now tradition has it that Abraham actually went to Mount Moriah, which was the mountain on which the temple was built, to offer Isaac. Now in Genesis chapter 14, and if we notice, after the Abraham or Abram here went ahead and pursued after the kings that had taken his brother Lot, and he came back with a booty from that pursuit, and it says in verse 18, it says, "And Melchizedek, king of Salem, king of peace." And Salem, presumably, is this place, Jerusalem. And this is the first record that we have within Scripture. "And he brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God." Now, we're not going to go into this, but to be priest of the Most High God, and we find out that he's perfect. You find that in Hebrews. He's clearly, there's no human being that is perfect, but this individual was. He must be, therefore, the Christ, the one that became Christ, and the Most High God would be the Father. Then, in fact, he was obviously teaching Abraham about the Father at that time. "And he blessed him, and he said, 'Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered your enemies into your hand.' And he gave him tithes of all." So here we see this first account in regarding Jerusalem. And if we turn then to Joshua, turn over to Joshua chapter 15. You see, what actually happened was that in the case of Jerusalem, now Jerusalem obviously faded, it was a place, the king of Salem, it was a place on the map, but it wasn't of any significance, except that Melchizedek was there, except that God had certain plans for it in that particular area. But you know, you don't see a great deal about it. But here we find in Joshua chapter 15, notice we find in verse 8, and it said, "And the border went up by the valley of the son of Hinnom, unto the south side of the Jebusite, the same is Jerusalem." Now the valley of Hinnom is this valley of Hinnom coming down the side, rather. And it says, "The same is Jerusalem." And that's the border. It was, in fact, if you, I don't know whether you want to go back to your map again and actually have a look at it again, but you'll find that you've got the Kidron Valley, the Hinnom Valley is coming down the bottom, the Valley of Hinnom, the Gehenna. And there's also another valley called the Tyropian Valley, the Valley of the Cheesemakers. And on either side, the Kidron Valley, which is this the valley where it'll run to the horses' bridles, on the east side of Jerusalem, and the Tyropian Valley, the piece of land between those two valleys, which is south of the Temple Mount, that is Zion. That's the citadel of Zion. That's the fortified area. That is the area that is being talked about here, where it says in verse 8 of Joshua 15, "The border went up from the valley of the son of Hinnom, the south side of the Jebusite, the same as Jerusalem. And the border went up the top of the mountains that lay before the valley of Hinnom westward, which is the end of the valley of the giants northward." So it gives certain description there. I want you to notice, though, verse 63. "As for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the children of Judah could not drive them out. But the Jebusites dwell with the children of Judah at Jerusalem unto this day." Now, what day was that? What day was this particular part written? And in fact, here in Joshua, the chances are that this was actually added by Samuel. So up to the time of Samuel, this particular, the Jebusites were in that particular area. Now, What in fact happened here in Jerusalem? Let me just read a little bit from Josephus, the Antiquities of the Jews. It says, and this is, if you want to put it down in your notes, book 7, chapter 3, how David laid siege to Jerusalem, and when he'd taken the city, he cast the Canaanites out of it. Who were these Jebusites that were in here? And remember, this was then from the time of Joshua, the time of the taking of this land, all the way through until David. So it was about, what, 400 years? Something around those that length of time. You're looking at a fair length of time that these Jebusites were in that particular area. It says, now the Jebusites, who were the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and were by extraction Canaanites. And you can find all those details in Genesis 10. You'll find about the sons of Ham, and one of whom was Canaan. And around about verse 15, 16, you'll find that the Jebusites came from Canaan. So it says, who were inhabitants of Jerusalem, and were by extraction Canaanites, shut their gates, and they paced the blind, the lame, and all the maimed persons upon the wall in way of derision of the king. This is to David now. So here were the Jebusites in their stronghold. This was hundreds of years after Joshua, and they had been there all the way through. And the land of Israel had all been conquered. But here, at this citadel, was the Jebusites. This was Mount Zion. And here, as I say, this piece of real estate has been fought over. It's got a bloody history to it. And here it says, the lame and all their maimed person upon the walls in the way of derision of the king. And they said that the very lame themselves would hinder his entrance into it. And this they did out of contempt of his power and as depending on the strength of their walls. And David was hereby enraged and began the siege of Jerusalem. So this really riled David. I mean, they were really poking fun at him, putting all these maimed and blind and all the rest of it along the walls and saying, look, these can defend this area because it was such a difficult place to take. So he took the lower city by force, but the citadel held out still. Whence it was that the king, knowing that the proposal of dignities and rewards would encourage the soldiers to greater actions, promised that he who should ascend to the citadel itself and take it should have the command of the entire people conferred upon him. And he writes on a little bit and he says, Joab, the son of Zeruiah, prevented the rest. In other words, he went before the rest. And as soon as he was got up to the citadel, he cried out to the king, and he claimed the chief command. So that's how Joab became the commander of the actual armies, is because he took this area, which the Jebusites had had for hundreds of years, all the way from the time of Joshua. And as Samuel wrote here in verse 63, and tacked this within the law, within this portion of the book of Joshua, saying that the Jebusites were dwelling there until that day. So David took the citadel. You can read about that in, let's turn over to 2 Samuel chapter 5. In 2 Samuel chapter 5. Here we see in verse 4, it says, David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. And Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over Israel and Judah. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem to the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, which spoke to David, saying, except you take away the blind, the lame, you're not going to come in here, thinking David couldn't come in. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, the same is the city of David. He made it then the city of David. That's why it's called the city of David. And David said on that day, whoever gets up into the gutter and smites the Jebusites, the same, the lame and the blind, will be the chief captain. And they said the lame and the blind shouldn't come in. And David dwelled in the fort and called it the city of David. And he built a roundabout from the Milo and inwards, in other words, from the tail end all the way back from the valley of Hinnom. And David went on and grew great, and the Eternal of Hosts was with him. So he then had that stronghold, the city of David, Mount Zion. And all the things that you see about Mount Zion, this is the area of land. This is the real estate, which lies from that valley, the valley of Jehoshaphat, which will be as deep as the horse's bridles when Christ comes, onto the Teropian Valley, which is the valley of the cheesemakers, on the other side of the temple, coming down the side. So you've got this like a V, and that area was known as Zion. In 2 Samuel, notice in chapter 6, notice in verse 3, and they said, they set the ark of God upon a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, who was in Gibeah and Uzzah and so on. And here you see, verse 6, When it came to the threshing floor, then Uzzah went and put his hand out. He was killed as a result of it. David, verse 10, wouldn't remove the Ark of the Eternal to the city of David, but he carried it and set it in this particular house. And then in verse 12, and it was told the king David, saying, the Eternal has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that pertains to him because of the Ark. So David then brought the Ark up, and the Ark then was brought forward to the city of David. Now, if you go back to your map again, there's you've got the city of David, which is south of the temple, and the Ark was then brought in, and the temple area then became the place which was crucial, which was north of the city of David. And these, obviously the Jebusites were long gone by that time. And it wasn't until, if we go to 2 Samuel chapter 7, 2 Samuel, I should have lost my place again. 2 Samuel chapter 7. And God tells David, and it says in verse 12, he says, and when your days be fulfilled, and you will sleep with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, which will proceed out of your bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. And he shall build a house for my name, and I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So here was Solomon, and the prophecy regarding Solomon and building a house within Jerusalem. Now God's had his hand in this area all the time. He had his hand regarding Melchizedek. Melchizedek was around this area, in the king of Salem. You're looking at Mount Moriah, where Abraham would have sacrificed Isaac. So it was all around this area. And here you see, yet he allows the Jebusites to stay in the citadel for a certain length of time, and then he gets David in there, and David brings the ark, and then he commissions Solomon. And all of these are leading step by step until finally Jerusalem will become the very headquarters of the universe. It is the most important piece of real estate that there is, really, in this world, and as I say, it could well be throughout the universe, because when you're looking at the situation in the longer term. If we notice over in 1 Chronicles, in 1 Chronicles 22, you find here in verse 14, here is David describing to Solomon, and he says, behold, in my trouble I have prepared for the house of the Eternal, in 100,000 talents of gold, 1,000, 1,000,000 talents of silver, and of brass and iron without weight, for the abundance and timber and stone I've prepared, that you may then add it thereto. Moreover, there are workmen in abundance, hewers and workers of stone and timber, and all manner of cunning work, of every manner of work. So here was David preparing the materials for the building of the temple itself. You've got the city of David in the south, and you've then got the temple area north of that. And it's something that, you know, Judy and I can certainly look back on, because we worked there for a number of months through the archaeological dig that was down there. And we were working on that corner. It was on the corner, on the southwestern corner of the Temple Mount. It was around that very area, around the city of David. And we were used to go through the dung gate. The Arab bus would come through the dung gate, up to the dung gate, and we'd then take the bus back, or we'd run through the old city to actually go back, which we were actually having digs on the northern side of the city. So we know the geography to some degree. Mind you, it was quite a few years ago, to say the least. But here, David prepares the materials, and he gets Solomon to make sure that he then uses those materials and adds to them. And in chapter 23, so when David was old and full of days, and he made Solomon his son king of Israel, and he gathered together all the princes of Israel and the Levite and the princes with the Levites. Notice in verse 6, and David divided them into courses among the sons of Levi, namely Gershon, Korah, and Merari. So not only did he provide the material for the temple, he also organized the singing. He organized the temple worship. David was the one that put all these things together and got the vision of the temple and what the temple was going to do and the place that the temple was going to be within Jerusalem, within this area of Jerusalem. And if we go over to 1 Kings, go back to 1 Kings again, and this is chapter 6, 1 Kings chapter 6, and we look at this time of David and Solomon, all the way, you know, that he was doing. So 1 Kings chapter 6, notice in verse 7, and the house, when it was in building, was built of stone, made ready before it was brought there, so that there was neither hammer or axe or any tool of iron heard in the house while it was being built. So we're seeing here in 1 Kings chapter 6 that this house, the entire house, it was put up and put together without any sound, without any problem, as far as the stonemasons and so on working. And altogether, if you notice in verse 38, it says, and in the 11th year of the month of Bull, which is the 8th month, was the house finished throughout all the parts thereof, and according to the fashion of it. So it was 7 years in building. So the actual house of God, this temple area, took 7 years altogether to put together and build. Now what then happened, as you know, is that they relied on the temple area, they relied in the fact that it was a piece of real estate. Their faith was on the real estate. It wasn't on the God that was behind it all, the one who's in fact made the place holy. And they caused no end of problems. Over in Jeremiah 52, turn over to Jeremiah. Jeremiah 52. And finally, what happened over in Jeremiah 52, says Zedekiah, in verse 1, was 21 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. So we had the division of Israel and Judah remained, and Jerusalem stayed within the hands of Judah. But here eventually, Zedekiah, 21 years old when he began to reign, reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna, and he did that which was evil in the eyes of the Eternal, according to all that Jehoiakim had done. For through the anger of the Eternal it came to pass in Jerusalem and Judah, till he had cast them out from his presence, that Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. And down in verse 12, notice, it says, now in the 5th month, in the 10th of the day of the month, which was the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, king of the guard, which served the king of Babylon, into Jerusalem. And he burned the house of the Eternal, and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, and all the houses of the great men he burned with fire. And the army destroyed this area of Jerusalem, and the army of the Chaldeans that were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls of Jerusalem round about. And the captain of the guard then carried away captives, the poor of the people, and the entire area of Jerusalem went into rack and ruin. The actual wall that went right the way round was broken down. So it was no longer fortified. And if you go back into your map, you'll see that the wall goes all the way around the entire area of Jerusalem. But the wall was broken down. And in fact, what it actually is written, it's described as a ploughed field. They made such a good job of this particular destruction that it was virtually a ploughed field when they got through with it. And they destroyed this area completely. So here is this area of real estate that is going to become the area that will be inhabited for eternity. And yet it's destroyed completely because of the attitude of the people within it. Now the only reason why the Jerusalem to come is going to hang on there is because of the attitude of the people within it, is the attitude of the ones that God will be placing in there, the change of the mind within those people. The Zion to come is not going to be just rely on the walls like the Jebusites did and said the poor, the blind, the lame, because we've got these wonderful walls. And what the Jews said, oh, we've got the temple. And they didn't go ahead and put their trust in all those kind of things. And God is preparing each and every one of us to understand, no, you don't put your trust in physical things. We've had buildings. We've had a house dedicated to the honor of the great God. And what happened to it? It was taken over by people that have got a mindset which is different. You see, Jerusalem, Yara, Shalom, means something. It's a name, and it means something. Zion, the waymark, means something. It's not just the real estate. The real estate has got to be accompanied. And so we see here, when we're looking at after from Babylon to the time of Christ, Nebuchadnezzar destroyed this completely. But when you go over to Daniel chapter 9, let's turn over to Daniel chapter 9. And Daniel understands by reading the books of Jeremiah, and these are, you know, you're looking at hundreds and hundreds of, in fact, thousands of years of history as we're going through here, and we're looking at this particular time, and all the time God is looking at this piece of real estate, this particular area that he's going to have for his people throughout eternity. Here in Daniel chapter 9, in verse 1, it says, "The first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years that the word of the Eternal came by to Jeremiah, the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolation of Jerusalem." So he's coming close to the end of the 70 years, and he could see that, no, this is the prophecy. Now we're going to finish the prophecy. Now Jerusalem will be rebuilt. "And I set my face to the Lord Eternal, to seek, Lord God, to seek by prayer and supplication with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. And I prayed unto the Lord my God, and made my confession, and said, Lord, the great and dreadful God, keeping the covenant and mercy of those that love him, and to them that keep his commandments. And we have sinned, we've committed iniquity, we've done wickedly, we've rebelled even by departing from the precepts and your judgments." And he set his mind to seek God. And the answer that came, notice over in verse 20. "And while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin, and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Eternal my God, for the holy mountain of my God." Yes, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, who I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me around the time of the evening oblation, the evening sacrifice. "And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give you the skill and the understanding. At the beginning of your supplication, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show you, for you are greatly beloved, therefore understand the matter and consider the vision. 70 weeks are determined upon your people and on the holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, and to make a reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and seal up the vision and the prophecy about, and to anoint the Most Holy." He goes into a prophecy about Christ. So that what in fact was given to, here was Daniel, and Daniel was given, was seeking God, and asking about Jerusalem, and saying, look, establish Jerusalem, let's have the 70 years is now finished. And he was looking at it physically. But what was the answer? The answer wasn't just the physical restoration of Jerusalem. The answer was, to, as it says here, it says, "and to bring in everlasting righteousness." This is his second coming now. "And to seal up the vision and the prophecy, and to anoint the Most Holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem to the Messiah, the Prince, will be 7 weeks and 72 weeks. So he gives the actual prophecy about the Messiah. And it even is looking forward into the second coming. There's a great deal more here than merely what Daniel was actually asking for. Now, what then happens once they actually go back and they rebuild Jerusalem, and Jerusalem then becomes becomes a city once again? Before Christ comes onto the scene, there's a fair amount of history goes over that particular area. First of all, Alexander the Great comes into the scene, because he takes over from the Medes and Persians, and he was welcomed by the Jews. They actually went out and met him, and he had a vision. Alexander the Great had this vision of these white-robed priests would come out to actually meet him, And he saw these white-robed priests coming out, or these priests in their robes, coming out to meet him, and he saw the result of his vision, and he spared Jerusalem. And it was also, they went to meet him because they had read in Daniel, and they had certain prophecies about Alexander the Great. And he saw the prophecies that were written in the books of Daniel. And this is what encouraged Alexander the Great. And he ruled for 10 years. He ruled that area a mere 10 years and died at age 32. And that was Alexander the Great. You know, this was, in fact, we don't even have much in the way of the records were written many, many years after Alexander actually lived. We don't have much in the way of records. In fact, I don't think we have anything of the way of records of that particular time at all. And then you have the generals then begin ruling. And in the time of the generals, you also have some problems. Now, as I said about the Jebusites, remember how the Jebusites were in control of the city of David? Well, during this time, when the generals, Antiochus Epiphanes, which you've obviously read about offering swine's blood on the altar, Antiochus Epiphanes came and took over this area, or was one of the generals that then took over the area, or the successors of the generals that took over the area. And the Maccabees brothers then led the revolt against what in fact he was doing. If I just quote from the book of Maccabees. Now, I don't normally quote from the Apocrypha, but the Apocrypha, as a historical basis, is fine. It's not books of the Bible. They're not holy books. They're not anything to do with Scripture. But as far as a historical basis is concerned, yes, they're fine to read the historical side. It says, in those days, this is Maccabees 1, verse 11, in those days there went out of Israel wicked men that persuaded many, saying, let us go and make a covenant with the heathen that are round about us. For since we departed from them, we've had much sorrow. So this device pleased them well, and certain of the people were so forward herein that they went to the king, who gave them license to do after the ordinance of the heathen. Whereupon they built a place of exercise at Jerusalem, according to the customs of the heathen. So they actually built the games. Remember, the Greeks had the games, and they built an amphitheatre, and they had the games, and made themselves uncircumcised, and forsook the holy covenant, and joined themselves to the heathen, and were sold to do mischief. So the actual Jews themselves started going aside. Now, when the kingdom was established before Antiochus, he thought to reign over Egypt, and that he may have dominion over the two realms. Therefore he entered into Egypt with great multitude of chariots and elephants and horsemen and a great navy. And he made war against Ptolemy, king of Egypt. But Ptolemy was afraid of him and fled, and many were wounded to death. Thus they got the strong cities in the land of Egypt, and he took the spoil thereof. And after that Antiochus had smitten Egypt, he returned again to the 143rd year, and went up against Israel and Jerusalem with a great multitude, entered proudly into the sanctuary, took away the golden altar and the candlestick of light and all the vessels thereof, and the table of the showbread and the pouring vessels and the vials and the censers of gold and the crowns and the golden ornaments that were before the temple, all of which he pulled off. And he also took the silver and the gold and the precious vessels, and he took the hidden treasures which he found. And when he had taken all away, he went to his own land, having made a great massacre, and spoke very proudly. And therefore there was great mourning in Israel, in every place where they were. So the princes and the elders mourned, and the virgins and young men were made feeble. And he goes on, it says, and after 2 years fully expired, the king sent his chief collector of tribute to the cities of Judah, that came to Jerusalem with a great multitude, and spoke peaceable words to them, and all was deceit. For when they'd given him credence, he fell suddenly on the city, and smote it very sore, and destroyed many people in Israel. And when he'd taken the spoils of the city, he set it on fire, pulled down the houses and walls on every side, and the women and children they took captive. And then they built the city of David with a great and a strong wall, and with mighty towers, and made a stronghold for them. So here were the Syrians coming into the city of David, this same area that the Jebusites were in. And they rebuilt the strong walls. They made it a stronghold, a citadel again. This is, again, you've got the area which is the Temple Mount. You've got the Kidron Valley. You've got the Teropian Valley. And you've got this area of the city of David. the area just south of where we were digging. And they put therein a sinful nation, wicked men, and fortified themselves therein, and they stored within it armor and victuals, and when they had gathered together the spoils of Jerusalem, they laid themselves up there, and then they became a sore snare, because they had water, they had food, they had armaments, and everything else. For it was a place to lie in wait against the sanctuary, and an evil adversary to Israel. So anybody going up to the temple, the city of David was actually higher. They built it up, and they were able to get on the wall, and it could fire straight into the temple area and kill people. They also came out at night, and they would massacre people, and then come behind the citadel again. They were doing just what the Jebusites had done. This is why David ruled in Israel for so many years, and then he ruled in Jerusalem, because Zion was being used in this way. It was, you know, is this Jerusalem, you know, Yaru, Shalom? It's anything but. It's the antithesis that is actually happening. Thus they shed innocent blood on every side of the sanctuary, and they defiled it, inasmuch as the inhabitants of Jerusalem fled because of them, whereupon the city was made an inhabitation of strangers, became strange to those that were born in her, and her own children left her. So this actually was happening, and Antiochus was the one that started the process. It was the Syrians that were actually in this area. The Zikari, I think they were used to actually be called, because they used, the Zikari was a small sword they would carry, concealed in the garments, and they would murder people and then come back inside. Murder, rob them, and come back inside the citadel. And that's what used to happen. Now, that was until an individual appeared, and this was the Maccabees. Now, the Maccabees were fighting against Antiochus and the Jews that in fact had allied themselves with him. And the younger brother called Simon. You see, if you go down to Jerusalem today, supposing you go down to where we were digging, and you actually go to the site, and you look down towards Gehenna, down to the south. You know, you're standing by, behind you, you've got the big, huge stones. You've got the Wailing Wall, which is over on your right, round the corner. And you come to perhaps you go up onto the actual old, the Turkish wall that is just in front of you, and you start to then look down into the Valley of Hinnom. And you're looking down at Mount Zion. It's not there. Mount Zion has gone missing. It's gone missing. And there's a reason it's gone missing. I mean, how do you get rid of a mountain? Because this thing was towering above the actual platform of the temple that's behind you. And it isn't there today. It's gone. The whole mountain has disappeared. And this, in Antiquity of the Jews, book 13, chapter 6, in verse 7, or section 7, then Josephus describes what actually happened. It actually happened during this time. He says, Simon, who was made high priest by the multitude on the very first year of his high priesthood, set his people free from their slavery under the Macedonians, under the Syrians there. He said he also took the citadel of Jerusalem by siege, and he cast it down to the ground, so it may not be of any more a place of refuge to their enemies when he took it to do them a mischief, as it had been till now. In other words, this had happened before with the Jebusites, and here it was happening with the Zikari. It was happening with the Syrians, and he made the decision, look, we're not going to have this happen again. Right beside the Temple Mount, there is this citadel, there's this fortified area that we can not get in if it ever gets taken by an enemy. And he says, and after he'd done this, he thought it the best way, and most to their advantage, to level the very mountain itself upon which the citadel happened to stand, that so the temple may be higher than it. And indeed, when he had called the multitude to an assembly, he persuaded them to have it so demolished, and this by putting them in mind what miseries they had suffered by its garrison and the Jewish deserters, and what miseries they might hereafter suffer in case any foreigner should obtain the kingdom and put a garrison into that citadel. This speech induced the multitude to compliance, because he exhorted them to do nothing but what was for their own good. So they all set themselves to their work and leveled the mountain, and in that work spent both day and night without any intermission, which cost them 3 whole years before it was removed, and brought to the entire level with the plain of the east of the city, after which the temple was the highest of all the buildings, and now the citadel as well as the mountain where it stood were demolished, and the actions were thus performed under Simon. So here we see what actually happened to Mount Zion. Mount Zion isn't there physically. So you find prophecies regarding Mount Zion, how it will stand forever. So what's it talking about? You and I are Mount Zion. You and I are the Zion of God, the waymarker, the ones that point the way for the future. As I say, it's not a piece of real estate. It's who is going to be there. That's what's important. And when you look at this particular account over in 139 BC, when he literally cut that mountain down, 3 years it took him, and he scraped the whole thing down, and you can stand on the wall today and look down towards the Gehenna, Valley of Gehenna, and you will find that there's no mountain there. It's gone. There's some Arab buildings when we were there, just in the lower part of the valley. And when you're looking at Jerusalem and you think of the time of Christ and you think of what kind of city it was at the time of Christ, well, Herod the Great actually made the entire city into a Hellenic city. The thing that they wanted, it's the reason why we say when we have some cow on our plate, we have some beef. We only have beef because the language was being used years and years ago, was it was posh to say le boeuf, which was French, rather than le cow, which was English. So we don't eat cow, we eat beef. And it's the same kind of thing. In the time of Christ, or as we came up to the time of Christ, what they looked at is they looked at anything that was Greek. This was the Roman world now, as being cultured and refined and all this kind of thing, and the Hellenic culture, and it was a Hellenic city. It was a Hellenic, and Helen of the area around that area of Greece. And so the Jerusalem that Christ actually was there, they actually enlarged the temple platform, the bedrock, they laid these huge stones down, these stones that presumably are the ones that now form the Wailing Wall. They expanded that entire platform, which is there to this day. They diverted the Teropian Valley River, the conduit. They built a huge hippodrome for the games, that was down towards the south. And there's a whole load of other palaces and expensive buildings. It became quite a center of culture. And this was the center that Christ actually came into. And this was the city that Christ walked through and dealt with people within. And if we turn over to Matthew chapter 23, Matthew chapter 23. Matthew 23, he's describing the Pharisees and their attitudes of mind. He says in verse 33, he says, "You serpents and generation of vipers, how can you escape the damnation of hell?" He says, "Wherefore, behold, I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed from the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, that you slew between the temple and the altar. Truly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that killed the prophets, stoned them that were sent to you, how often would I have gathered your children together, even as a hen gathers his chickens under his wing, but you would not. Behold, your house is lying to you desolate. But I say to you, you will not see me from this time until you say, blessed be he that comes in the name of the Lord," looking down into his second coming. "And Jesus went out, and he departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple." Which also, he came up, I think after that, he came up with riding on an ass after that as well? I think he did, so that's probably what he's referring to. "And Jesus said to them, do you see these things? I say to you, there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." So here was this Hellenic city, this beautiful temple that had been built by Herod at great expense, and all the various buildings along, associated with it. But Christ makes that prophecy that not one stone was going to be left upon another. Now, in 70 AD, Titus destroyed the area, and Josephus actually made the comment that no one could even believe that there was a city there once the erosion then filled the valleys. Now, this was going a little bit further on. A small city then was allowed by Rome, and in about 132 to 135, the Bar Kokhba revolt was squashed by Hadrian, and it became Aelia Capitolina, and he literally, you could plough the ground where the city had been, and the Jews were banned for 20 miles. So again, you're looking at an attitude of mind within people, and how God just allows, you know, physical things are not what counts. It's what's going on in God's people that is so vitally important. You then go into the Christian period, various times where you have the Byzantine city, you have the Muslim period, and basically the Dome of the Rock, I think it's around 638 AD, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and you have the European Crusades, and then finally you have the Turkish rule. And that goes right the way through to a particular date, and that date was the 8th of December, 1917. Now the 8th of December, 1917, was the time that Allenby was given the keys to the city, that particular day. Now, why is that specifically an important date to remember? Turn over to Haggai chapter 2. Turn over to Haggai chapter 2. Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. So Haggai chapter 2. Here in Haggai 2, verse 10, in the 24th day of the ninth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Eternal by Haggai the prophet, saying, thus says the Lord of hosts. And I've read this several times about the ask the priest concerning the law, one bearing holy flesh in his garment, and so on. And down in verse 15, and now I pray you, consider from this day and upwards, from before a stone was laid upon a stone in the temple of the Eternal, since those days, and it goes on, from this day, he said, look, consider it. He says, verse 18, consider now from this day and upwards, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from the day that the foundation of the Eternal's temple was laid, consider it, just notice it. You see, when Allenby took the key for the city, that 8th of December, 1917, was this day. This specific day. Now, you say, well, what actually happened then? It was the foundation of the Jewish state. It was the foundation of the city under the present situation. And that will last then from that particular date all the way through until when? Until you have the prophecies that regard the 1,335 days that start, and all the prophecies then flow into the return of Christ. And it was this specific day of the year. You know what day it actually falls on this year? I looked it up just before it came. It's Christmas Day. It's 25th of December this year. But this particular day, this particular year in 1917, it was the 8th of December. This particular specific day. And the foundation of the State of Israel was being laid. And the Gentile rule was being removed. And it was quite a profound situation. And also, what was going on then within the church at that particular time? You start thinking, well, what was going on then? What was Mr. Armstrong doing? Well, he hadn't been baptized. He'd just got married. And do you remember that dream that he had, his wife had? It was around about this time. I say around about this time. I think it was actually before this particular date. But it was around that time where God started working with Mr. Herbert Armstrong. And the foundation for the church was also being laid around this same date, 1917, the 8th of December. It was his wife was pregnant with their first child, who was born then in May the following year in 1918. They'd just been married, I think, in June. They first got married. They had that dream sometime around that time. His wife had this dream where Christ was returning, and they were being called. They were being called for a specific purpose. So when we're looking at these things, you know, God doesn't do things by halves. And it was the fact that Allenby, who was the of Ephraim, and Allenby walked into the city and was given the keys on that specific day. So it is quite a profound situation when we look at, in fact, what happened. It wasn't until about 1927, 10 years later, that Mr. Armstrong was actually baptized and started his study of God's Word. And you come all the way through till today, and you find, in fact, that Jerusalem is in a contentious position. Turn over to Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah just over a few pages. In verse 1 of chapter 12, it says, "The burden of the word of the Eternal for Israel, says the Eternal, which stretches forth the heavens and lays the foundation of the earth and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem." So who is it that's making Jerusalem, this real estate? Who is it that's going to make this Jerusalem this way? "I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling to all the peoples around about." And you know, what are they wanting today? They're wanting a Palestinian state. Where's the capital that they want? They want it in Jerusalem. What does God say? "I'll make it a cup of trembling." And this area of this real estate in this the world today is a real meaningful place. It's a real place. It's a place that God's got a great deal of interest in. It's something that the prophecies have a great deal to say about. He's had his hand in it for thousands of years. And here it says, round about, "When they shall be in the siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem, and this in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all the people. All that burden themselves with it will be cut to pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it." So even though the entirety of the earth gathers against this one area of real estate, God says they're going to be cut to pieces. It doesn't make any difference, because God says that this is what, in fact, is going to happen. Now, I've got a quotation here from the Palestinian Authority chief. Says, "No Jerusalem, no peace." This is coming from IsraelNationalNews.com. And it says, "No Israel, no Jerusalem, no peace," declared Prime Minister, Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Ahmed Kouria at the special cabinet meeting of the Palestinian Authority's government on Monday. This was dated Tuesday, the 13th of December. Kouria, also known by the name he used, the PLO terrorist Abu Alaa, is a senior Palestinian official, second to the chief Mahmoud Abbas. He promised that the Palestinian Authority would never give up its demand for sovereignty over Jerusalem and goal of making it the capital of a Palestinian state. That goal, he said, has become the Palestinians' primary consideration for peace with Israel. In other words, they're not going to let go of that particular demand. And he goes on in that particular article. Now, what's going to happen? It says he'll be a burdensome stone for all the peoples, all that burden themselves with it. This is going to be causing problems. It's going to be causing problems within that area and problems within the world. Another area of people that are burdening themselves currently with it, this is coming from eyeonthe.un.org, and this is coming from somebody called Halevi, and he says, "The United Nations held a day of solidarity with the Palestinian people last week." This was again the beginning of December, 8th of December this is dated. "A large map of Palestine," in quotes, "with an Israel literally wiped off the map, featured prominently in the festivities. The ceremony was held at the UN headquarters in New York and was attended by the Secretary General Kofi Annan and the Presidents of the UN Security Council and the General Assembly." Now you just think about that. The UN is getting involved and is tacitly giving support to the Palestinian Authority. And they have a map. In fact, I haven't got a picture of it here, but, well, yes I do, it's a very small picture there, but I've got a picture, there's pictures at home of this map that was actually behind the speakers, and there's no Israel on the map whatsoever. Who do you think controls Jerusalem? And yet it says here, "And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people." And it will carry on as a burdensome stone all the way through until those feet touch the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives splits, and one goes north, one goes south, and the blood in that valley of Jehoshaphat is up to the horses' bridles. And we're looking, we are living in momentous times at this particular time. We really are. And we are looking for the emergence of this area of the world as being utterly, utterly crucial. I know how many people are in Jerusalem. I looked up the statistics of what's the population of Jerusalem. It's 662,000 people. As a city, it's nothing. 662,000 people. It's not a large city by any stretch of the imagination. But nevertheless, it is something that God has got a distinct eye on, and he will, in fact, make sure that his prophecies are maintained. Here in Zechariah, as we are here already, notice over in verse 8 of chapter 13, verse 8, it says, "And it shall come to pass that in all the land, says the Eternal, two parts thereon shall be cut off and die, but the third will be left therein. And I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will test them as gold is tried, and they will be cast. They will call on my name, and I'll hear them, and I will say, it's my people, and they shall say, the Eternal is my God." Presumably that is Israel. Now, there are other scriptures that talk about a tenth of, not Israel, this is Judah, that talks about a tenth of Israel actually surviving. But it looks like Judah, there will be about a third which will survive in that particular area, it appears. And we go on then into chapter 14. We've read the section about his feet standing on the Mount of Olives. And it says in verse 5, "And you shall flee in the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains will reach to Azal. Yes, you will flee as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And the Eternal your God shall come, and all the saints with you. And it shall come to pass in that day," verse 6, "that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it will be one day which shall be known to the Eternal, not day or night, but it will come to pass at even time that it will be light." In other words, the light will presumably be there, presumably as Christ actually descends, and will light the area when he's actually fighting, and the battle, this final battle, will take place. "And it shall be in that day that living waters will go out from Jerusalem, half towards the former sea," that's the Dead Sea, "half towards the hinder sea," in the summer, that's the Mediterranean. So it's going in both directions, going through that valley, through the which has been created when the valley actually splits, and the Mount of Olives rather splits, and the water then pours through that valley down to the Dead Sea. It says, "In summer and winter shall it be, and the Eternal shall be king over all the earth in that day, and there will be one Lord, and his name one. All the land shall be turned as a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. And it," that's Jerusalem, "shall be lifted up and be inhabited in a place from Bethlehem's gate until the gate of the first gate," and so on. So here it gives specific areas that the entire area around Jerusalem is going to become a plain. Now, if you go and find where Geba is, that's 5 miles north of Jerusalem. And if you go and find where Rimmon is, it's 30 miles south of Jerusalem. So you're looking at an area, 35 miles, which was flat, which was made into a plain. This area, which, you know, the area around Jerusalem. And yet Jerusalem itself is going to be raised up. So at the time that Christ actually returns, the earthquakes and the topology of the land is going to change. And there's going to be a flat area, this huge flat area, that will actually be constructed, and the Mount of Jerusalem will be lifted up. We turn back to Ezekiel 45. Ezekiel 45. You find here that the area that will be surrounding this particular area of Jerusalem will in fact be part of this holy area. In Ezekiel 45, verse 1, it says, "Moreover, when you will divide by lot the land for inheritance, you will offer an oblation unto the Eternal, a holy portion of the land. The length shall be," now this is in the millennium now, "the length shall be 25,000 reeds." And if it depends on what, in fact, they're assuming it's a reed. Now, if that is the case, there's about 6 cubits, is about 10 feet. It works out at about 47 by about 19 miles. So it goes beyond this area that was mentioned, which you're looking at about something like 35 miles north to south. You're looking at about, say, 47 miles. So it goes into the hill country on the outer side as well. And presumably you're looking at about 19 miles, so something like 19, 20 miles wide this plain will be. So this is a huge plain area that will be constructed, and Jerusalem itself will then be raised up. So you'll come into the area of Jerusalem in the millennium, and you'll see this vast plain, and you'll see this city. You know, you look at the Walt Disney ideas of castles and all the rest of it, and this is the idea that people have had. And here it is described within Zechariah and also in Ezekiel. And this area of this plain will be the area where you and I will dwell. It will be a holy area. It will be a reserved area. There'll be certain people that will be living in that area who will be linked to the temple, the Levites that will be serving in the temple. But it will be an area for... will be holy for the it'll be an oblation unto the eternal, unto the very God himself. Turn over to Revelation 21. In Revelation 21, we see Jerusalem right into the future now. And in verse 1 it says, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for a husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle, the dwelling of God, is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God." So this Jerusalem in the millennium will be a type for the New Jerusalem. And the New Jerusalem will be the antitype. And he said, "And God will wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there will be no more death or sorrow or crying, nor any of these things ever, any more pain, because the former things have passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. And he says, It's done. I'm Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I'll give unto them that are thirst of the fountains of the water of the life freely." And again, you're looking at the millennium. The waters are going to both seas, literally. And yet in here we're seeing it's a type. It's a type of what will come at the end of all things, when the New Jerusalem will be there as a spirit city. And that spirit city will in fact rule the entire universe. "He that overcomes will inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son." It's the people that are there that are going to be the true Zion, the true way marker, the marker of the way. That's what we're here to learn. That's why it's so important. In verse 10, "And he carried me away in the spirit to the great and high mountain, and showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God." So here we see this city that comes down. In verse 16 it says, "It lies four square, the length and large as the breadth, and he measured the city with a reed, and it is 12,000 furlongs, about 1,000 miles by 1,000 miles. So again, this area is even more huge than what you'll find within the millennium. The millennium will be fairly tame in regard to this. And he says the length, the breadth, and the height are proportional, it should say, rather than equal. It doesn't mean to say they're going to be 1,000 miles high and you've got this thing kind of going around the earth every time it goes around the earth. That's not what it's actually talking about. It's proportional. And in chapter 22, notice verse 1, "And I showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and out of the Lamb. And the midst of the street of it," or the passage, the actual riverbed of it, "and on either side of the river there was a tree of life that bare 12 manner of fruits." And it goes down to verse 5, "And there will be no night there, and they will not need a candle, neither the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign for ever and ever." From this area of Jerusalem. And in verse 14, notice, it says, "Blessed are they that do his commandments," his Torah, Yara Shalom, using the Torah as part of that "do his commandments, that they may have right to the tree of life, and may enter into the gates of the city." This city is a crucial area, a crucial piece of real estate. Final scripture over in Isaiah 66. Isaiah 66. Because we go through life and we have all the problems and difficulties that we face. This city is to give us the release and the relief that we are looking for. As it says here in Isaiah chapter 66, notice in verse 1, it says, "This says the Eternal, the heaven's my throne, the earth is my footstool. Where's this house that you're going to build for me? Where's the place of my rest? Where's the Mount Zion? Where is the Mount Moriah? Where is the temple?" It says, "For all these things are my hands have made. All these things have been," says the Eternal, "but to this will I look." This is the house. This is the one that he's looking to. "Even to him that is of a poor and a contrite spirit and that trembles at my word." It's a certain individual with a character, with an attitude of mind, an approach that is necessary. This is the true temple. This is the true one in which the Godhead will dwell for eternity. In verse 9, notice, he says, "Shall I bring to the birth and not cause to bring forth?" says the Eternal. "Will I cause to bring forth and shut the womb?" says your God. "Rejoice with Jerusalem, with Yara Shalom, and be glad with her, all you that love her. Rejoice for joy with her, all you that mourn for her." And it's the people that are going to be there. And we look at the church, you look at this shattered church, and we do mourn for the church. We do. But it says, no, God will sort this area out. "That you may suck and be satisfied with the breasts of her consolations, that you may milk out and be delighted with the abundance of her glory," because we will actually see the glory of this area of real estate. "For thus says the Eternal, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river, pouring peace," Yara Shalom, "extending peace to her like a river, and the glory of the Gentiles like a flowing stream. Then you will suck, and you will be borne on her sides, and you'll be dangled on her knees." And you've got this area that you're looking at. You're looking something like 47 miles by 19 miles. This area, and somewhere in there, there'll be a place for those that are God's sons. "And as one whom his mother comforts, so I will comfort you, and you shall be comforted in Jerusalem." That will actually happen to God's people. And it goes on beyond there. If you go back to the preceding chapter, in chapter 65, notice in verse 17, it says, "For behold, I create new heavens, new earth, and the former will not even be remembered or come into mind." So even this, the millennial rule, even this millennial Jerusalem won't even come into mind. "But you shall be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create, for behold, I create Jerusalem," Yara Shalom, "a rejoicing and her people a joy. And I will rejoice in Yara Shalom," this river of peace, "and joy in my people, and the voice of weeping shall be no more heard in her, nor the voice of crying." That's the future that we have. And that is going to be our future as far as this piece of real estate, the most important piece of real estate probably in the universe at this time. And it is to be ours as the very family of the kingdom of God for eternity.